loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Nicole Roussel. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Google has been reeling from an employee protest over the use of artificial intelligence for military purposes. So CEO Sundar Pichai told employees yesterday that the company will not use AI for weapons or for surveillance that violates human rights. Google will continue to work with governments and with the military, though. Next, the FBI yesterday arrested James Wolf, the recently retired director of security for the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was charged with 3 felony counts of making a false statement. Wolf is under further investigation for revealing classified information to a reporter with whom he had a personal relationship, Ali Watkins of the New York Times. More troubling is the revelation that the FBI seized several years' worth of Watkins and Wolf's electronic communications. Then the trials of J20 protesters continued this week in Washington, but with repeated setbacks for the prosecution. Yesterday, 4 defendants were either acquitted on all charges or acquitted on some, and the jury deadlocked on others. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia will have to decide whether to retry on those counts. But so far, this has been nothing but a black eye for the government. And then Brazil took another step into privatization yesterday when they auctioned off some of their nation's oil fields. This is just days after truckers in Brazil ended their 10-day strike over fuel prices, increasing the chaos under Temer's rule since the parliamentary coup 2 years ago. And finally, it's Friday. We look at the worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Google has been reeling from an employee protest over the use of artificial intelligence for military purposes. So CEO Sundar Pichai told employees yesterday that the company will not use AI for weapons or for surveillance that violates human rights. Google will continue to work with governments and the military, though. We're joined from Sydney, Australia by Paul Wallace. He's a technology reporter and Digital Journal's editor-at-large for op-eds. He's also the author of many books, including Wanderlaff. Paul, welcome.
Hi.
Paul, this is there's a lot more to this story than meets the eye. It's one thing to say that you've decided not to use artificial intelligence for military purposes. It's not so easy or clear cut, frankly, to implement that. Tell us what this announcement means. And at the end of the day, does it really mean that Google is not going to provide AI to the military?
Google is in a spot at the moment. This is gold rush time for artificial intelligence. Everybody wants a piece of it, and we're not talking about just a sort of generic type of artificial intelligence. We're talking about possibly thousands or millions of different kinds of artificial intelligence. The fact is that artificial intelligence in the military is pretty much inevitable. Google has been working on core systems like autonomous vehicles and so forth, no doubt with the best of intentions. But it doesn't follow that that class of technology can't be used as a sort of springboard for autonomous weapon systems and so forth. The whole history of military development since the Bronze Age has been highly competitive. And right at the moment, there are God knows how many forms of corporate entities trying to compete and get into what is going to be the hottest property in artificial intelligence. What Google does or doesn't do is ultimately going to be driven by the market.
You know, I read just this morning that this contract actually was minuscule by Google standards. It was a $50 million contract. And frankly, it's not really up to Google to decide what AI is developed and used by the Pentagon, is it? I mean, you have DARPA, for example, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that's right here in Northern Virginia. They're the ones that are developing and using a lot of this technology. So would you say that DARPA would just be able to go around Google and use another company or even develop the technology on its own?
With ease. DARPA is in a very tough position at the moment. The current state of technology is that the next generation systems will be artificially intelligent. And the problem with that is that the choice is either don't develop the technology or let the other guys develop the technology. And from a purely military point of view, there is no reason to believe that other countries will not develop artificial intelligence. They cannot really dodge that. So whether Google's involved or not is going to be a relatively minor issue. My feeling is that Google will have to be involved at some point. I think DARPA would prefer if Google were involved, but the fact is the market's going to drag it along whether it likes it or not.
Definitely. And so when we're thinking about DARPA, I mean, if that organization is really the agency that's going to be driving these decisions, what do we know about DARPA, John?
We know that they're developing all kinds of futuristic battlefield weapons and tools. In fact, there's been a lot of press reporting that DARPA is developing a laser right now that could be used in the future to blind opposing soldiers rather than kill them on the battlefield. Somehow that's supposed to be more humane. But it's these kinds of futuristic weapons or weapon systems or technologies that DARPA is charged with creating and developing.
Paul, go ahead.
Problem being that at the same time, there is every reason to believe that other countries are developing very powerful systems. The U.S. technology in lasers, by the way, has gone a long way. They have developed what is now going to be an air-mounted laser, which is an extremely efficient weapon. It'll be mounted on fifth, and that's current generation fighters, and sixth generation fighters, which will be almost entirely dependent on automation, meaning, of course, artificial intelligence in some form. As it is, the existing fifth generation fighters are based on what's called fly-by-wire technology. Human beings simply cannot keep up with the pace of the automated systems, and AI is the incoming solution to everything that's going to be happening with the next generation of weapons. So the result is that DARPA has a choice. They can either sit on the fence and sort of develop these systems. The US future military program is incredible. It really is. It's huge. But again, reality is going to get in touch with them. And the question is just going to be, should we not develop this stuff when we know perfectly well others are developing?
I just think one of the biggest problems, and we've talked about this on the show before, but one of the biggest problems with these sorts of AI developments and these kind of tech improvements and changes in military is that you really take, it's a dehumanizing effect when you're talking about going to war,
oh,
right?
Yes.
When you are able, like you said, John, to from a plane, from a, from on high, be able to just blind other people. And, you know, when we've had ground wars, that's when America is kind of paying attention. That's when the residents of the country are really listening and keeping their eyes and ears open because we have skin in the game, right? But when we don't, I definitely start to worry about, you know, how many more countries we will invade just from the air. And we're already doing that from drones, but this will make it even worse.
Unfortunately, the body bag count is likely to be one of the arguments for artificial intelligence. The horrendous wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The solution is going to be, it's just a vehicle that can go and do anything. The trouble is with the weapon systems that are coming in, this includes extremely powerful long-range weapons like USS Zumwalt is currently using. When that turns into common currency in the combat field, people are going to be saying, well, look, we don't need to do this. You know, we can just go in and blow up a few of the bad guys. And yet another argument for AI. And the problem is very large numbers of people are likely to get killed through this. You know, it's going to be horrific one way or another.
Paul, we were talking before we started recording here earlier this morning. Are you imagining applications that are going to be able to be switched from domestic to military? What are you envisioning?
Fortunately, I am. If you think about it, the original tank was developed from farm equipment. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine a fridge which can order your groceries and simultaneously fire off a few Hellfire missiles when it feels like it, and remotely control a UAV somewhere over the Middle East or wherever. The Internet of Things could turn into a terrible own goal in that regard. It can never be secure. It can never be properly monitored at any given time. It's a sort of accident waiting to happen. But the thing is that it's going to be using much the same technology, and you can just sort of patch it through to whatever system it needs to run.
I mean, that's the stuff out of sci-fi horror films. I mean, that's absolutely insane.
Sure is.
Look, I tell you now, your average high school student shown what to do could probably write the code for it. It's not difficult. AI is bleating a lot about algorithms and things like that, but basic autonomic functions and click and do this are well within anybody's grasp. You know, the technology is advanced in many ways, but a lot of the basics, particularly the combat versions, are anything but advanced. you know, a kid could do it, literally. Extremely dangerous. And when you bear in mind the kind of agents that are playing around the world in that artificial intelligence, which is also going to be very strong espionage hot property.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about these security risks.
Yeah, this has to be a huge espionage target. I mean, and look at Washington. Washington has more spies than any city on the planet. It seems to me that AI and DARPA and Google would be top targets for a whole number of foreign intelligence services.
Absolutely. And this is very big money espionage, too. Any working system, anything which is sort of instantly translatable into a real product in terms of a working combat system will be top priority. And, the endless cyber attacks and so forth, it's very unlikely that something isn't going to leak somewhere. And whoever's doing it, particularly an obvious target like Google, if something falls off the wagon and somebody else picks it up, you can assume that this culture, which, as I said earlier, is gold rush time. This is gigantic amounts of money, particularly with the military-industrial complex. Anybody and his dog will be in it, and any information which comes out, the leaks will just be endless.
Well, I think we have to leave it right there, John.
We do. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We were joined from Sydney, Australia by Paul Wallace, a technology reporter and digital journals editor-at-large for Op-Eds. Paul is also the author of many books, including Wanderlaff. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Nicole Russell, who's sitting in for Brian Becker. The FBI yesterday arrested James Wolf, the recently retired director of security for the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was charged with three felony counts of making a false statement. Wolf is under further investigation for revealing classified information to a reporter with whom he had a personal relationship, Allie Watkins of the New York Times. More troubling is the revelation that the FBI seized several years' worth of Watkins and Wolf's electronic communications. We're joined from Washington by Jim Jatrist. He's a political analyst, a former U.S. diplomat, and a former senior foreign policy advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
So, Jim, walk us through this. It seems funny to me that the Justice Department would heap on false statements charges, which are minor charges, although they're felonies, they're minor charges, without something else behind it. And, you know, you read between the lines of this case and you keep thinking, when do they file an espionage charge? So what exactly is going on here?
John, there's a lot about this that strikes me as rather fishy. I look at when somebody gets charged with making false statements to the FBI as rather the opposite indication, like we saw with Paul Manafort and George Papadopoulos, is that when they don't have the goods on somebody for actual criminal behavior and they want to nail him for something, they get him for, quote, lying to the FBI, which in most cases, I don't think they have. They've simply maybe gotten some facts wrong when they were being questioned by the agents and whatever they wrote down on their 302. So I do wonder what's going on here. I mean, the Intelligence Committee is a very unique committee on Capitol Hill. This is both true of the House and Senate. It's one of the most bipartisan committees, nonpartisan committees, as opposed to, say, you know, foreign relations or almost on any of the other legislative committees. So this fellow Wolf, whom I don't know, has been there for a long time, worked under both Republicans and Democrats. I suppose the real question that comes back to me is, where is this coming from? Is this coming, if you will, from the Trump people trying to nail somebody who's been leaking in a way that's damaging to them? Or is this somehow related to the, if you will, the deep state that's been trying to get Trump all along, for which leaking is part of their modus operandi, and for some reason they want to nail this guy Wolf? And I don't know which of those it is.
Tell me also what exactly this guy did on the committee. He's mentioned in the press as the director of security. He had this job for 30 years. What does the director of security do on the Intelligence Committee?
I don't know the exact job description of that committee, but as I say, it's a pretty much a nonpartisan committee. My expectation would be is that, as the name would indicate, he was responsible for making sure that classified information, sensitive information, even if it's not classified, remains, let's say, in its appropriate track, that's not diverted for other uses, either political or for some public use that's not authorized. So, look, that's a two-edged sword. It can be that at the same time you're protecting the information, you can, if you want to, use it selectively for political purposes through leaking to the press. But the only question then that raises for me is that's hardly rare on Capitol Hill. Again, why is this guy being targeted?
So it seems to me, too, that the real target here is Ali Watkins, this New York Times journalist who had been previously at Politico and before that at BuzzFeed. She was not the SSCI, the Senate Intelligence Committee journalist. She was a broader national security and law enforcement journalist. It seems that the Justice Department is saying that Wolf passed her classified information. And so the Justice Department seized years worth of their electronic data. This is phone calls, or at least the metadata of phone calls going back and forth, text messages going back and forth. The New York Times today said more than 10,000 text messages that they exchanged over the years. What would they do with that metadata if it doesn't include any of the actual texts?
I think maybe part of that would be one thing you want to do with metadata is you're then trying to find other connections. In other words, that it's not so much what the content of it is, but who else was she talking to? Who else was she exchanging information with? And again, I do find this somewhat mystifying. Look, generally, the New York Times or the other major media, which are often very closely allied with people in the, not only in the Intelligence Committee on Capitol Hill, but with the intelligence services themselves, are part of what I would regard as one integrated deep state operation. In other words, why is the monster eating one of its own? And that strikes me as very odd indeed.
Yeah, I was struck by the Justice Department's decision to go after a working journalist. And there was a statement that came out of Justice Today, which was also a surprise, something I had never seen before, saying that they had exercised all other ways or methods to get the information that they need. When they determined that there was no other way to get the information, they went after the journalist. So give me your opinion. Do you think this is something we're going to be seeing more commonly?
I don't know. It really gets down to the question of who is behind this decision. Who, you know, has there been an ongoing investigation here into what? What are they really aiming at with this particular move? Whose motivations are behind it? And as I keep saying, put it into the larger context of what has been roiling Washington for well over a year now, which is this resistance within the apparatus of government, the permanent government, against the incoming administration. Whose side is this particular initiative on? And I don't think we know that. My instinct is to say it's not coming from the top, because it's quite clear to me that the White House and the administration really doesn't have effective control over the machinery of law enforcement.
Right, right. I could see that. So do you think that this is coming from a level below Jeff Sessions, or do you think there's a split between Sessions and the White House?
Well, that's a good question. I sort of wonder if Jeff Sessions is really the Attorney General at all, except for things on marijuana and civil forfeiture. When it comes to the real big issue of what I regard as an anti-constitutional conspiracy within elements of the U.S. government, by the way, let's not forget, in collusion, not with the Russians, but with elements of the British deep state, I can't help but wonder, since the White House certainly does not control any of that, and I don't think Jeff Sessions does either, and if it is coming from, if you will, the bowels of the bureaucracy somewhere, what is the motivation? Who's behind it? And is it designed to cover something up, perhaps? I don't know.
You know, it's my personal experience that's exactly where these cases come from, and that's the bowels of the Justice Department. It's usually not the top people at the Department of Justice who even know that these cases are being developed. They're informed once a decision has been made to make an arrest that there's a case. But yeah, these decisions are made at the level of the U.S. attorney or even the assistant U.S. attorneys.
Exactly right. And look, you know, maybe I'm overthinking this. Maybe we would just put on our, you know, our middle school civics class hat and say, maybe somebody somewhere in the working levels of the department became aware of what they thought was criminal activity and they're pursuing it as they're supposed to do. Maybe that's all that's going on here. Then it still makes me wonder, though, why the charge of lying? Where's the real evidence of wrongdoing if that's what they're really after, as opposed to, frankly, I think it's a chump's charge to say, oh, well, he lied to us. Well, that means you don't actually have anything on the guy.
You know, that was actually my first question when I first heard about this story last night. This is what's called a throwaway charge. It's a charge that they levy when they just can't think of anything else to charge you with. If the guy passed classified information, they would have indicted him for passing classified information. As you said, he probably didn't lie to the FBI. He probably forgot a detail or got a detail wrong in his memory or accidentally omitted a detail. And then you get a charge. Now, they can negotiate away some of these charges, and I suspect that's what they're going to end up doing. But at the same time, you know, if this guy tries to save himself by taking a plea just to make it go away, he still ends up with a felony conviction.
Well, John, does anybody in the universe know that better than you? I mean, we know how this works. Is that, you know, like they used to say in the good old NKVD, give us the man, we'll give you the case. When you start by targeting an individual, yeah, you can find something to get him for if you really want him. If nothing else, you scramble the answers to a question and then get him on multiple charges of lying and then have him plead guilty to something. That's become, unfortunately, standard operating practice. I don't know that that's what's going on here, but I like to say my spidey sense tends to perk up when I hear a lying to the FBI charge.
Former Attorney General Robert Jackson, who was Attorney General at the very end of the Franklin Roosevelt administration, warned us about this. He said that prosecutors should look for a crime and then find the person who committed a crime, rather than to find a person they don't like and then scour the law books to find the crime to pin on him. And I wonder if that's something that we're seeing here. We've certainly seen it over the last 9 years in other contexts.
Exactly right. Now, look, maybe that's not what's happening here. Maybe there really was a crime and these guys are just doing their job. But if, for the sake of discussion, since we have seen so much of it, that is what is happening here. That's when you get back to the motivation. All right, then, who's targeting this guy and why? What is it? What is their real objective here? And I tend to think it's of a political nature, not of a law enforcement nature, if that's what's happening.
That was the voice of Jim Jattras. He joined us from Washington. Jim's a political analyst, a former U.S. diplomat, and a former senior foreign policy advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Nicole Russell, sitting in for Brian Becker. The trials of J20 protesters continued this week in Washington, but with repeated setbacks for the prosecution. Yesterday, four defendants were either acquitted on all charges or acquitted on some, and the jury deadlocked on others. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia will have to decide whether to retry on those counts, but so far, this has been nothing but a black eye for the government. We're joined here in the studio by Chip Gibbons. Chip is the Policy and Legislative Counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. He's contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book The Henry Kissinger Files. Chip, good to have you.
Thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, John.
Chip, I'm still perplexed.
And I am too.
I know I've asked you this
too.
A million times.
I am too.
But why are they even continuing with these cases? There's still 47 or 49 cases pending.
It's complex because there was 59 people. They dropped the charges against the majority of people except for 59. 10 people had their charges dismissed in a variety of ways last week due to the Brady violations, which I can talk about later. And then this week, of the four people who were on trial, one was acquitted entirely after just less than 2 days to deliberation, which is absolutely humiliation for the prosecution. One was acquitted on every charge except for one, engaging in a riot, which is a misdemeanor, which was a mistrial on that charge. One was acquitted on assaulting a police officer, then deadlock on all other charges. And one was deadlocked on all charges. So it's very confusing to think what would happen if they retried them. And there's also the issue of the due process violations and the Brady violations, because these are, you know, people are being tried in groups of 4 to 6. Different judges have different cases, so they make different rulings. So while the prosecution was giving their closing argument in this case, another judge, literally the floor above in the courthouse, was sanctioning the prosecution for committing a Brady violation.
Right.
Same Brady violations in this case, in two other cases. And in that what happened was that the prosecution got this video from Project Veritas, a right-wing organization that isn't particularly reputable.
And it's been in trouble many times
their
for some of its tactics.
Founder James O'Keefe was convicted of a crime of deception in rules of evidence in trials. Being convicted of a crime of deception is usually grounds for impeachment. It's frowned upon in terms of your integrity. And they had this video and they edited. They showed in the first trial an edited version of it, and they claimed all they took out was the identity of an undercover officer and the identity of quote-unquote Matt, the Project Veritas infiltrator. And the judge, Judge Morin, who of the three judges that heard the case, is the only one who's not a former prosecutor. He's a former defense attorney. He did death penalty work in the South. He worked with the Southern Center for Human Rights during death penalty litigation. So you can imagine his rulings are notably different.
Yes.
And I think that speaks to the need to why we need more criminal defense attorneys and less prosecutors.
That's right.
On the judiciary. And he made them show the whole unedited video. And it turned out the prosecution had cut exculpatory evidence that the Project Veritas person says, I don't think those IWW guys, Industrial Workers of the World, know anything. And they're on trial for conspiracy to riot. And it's like, I don't think they know anything. And over the week, it came out there were 69 more recordings from Project Veritas that they had withheld from defense. Jennifer Kirkhoff, the assistant U.S. attorney, told Judge Morin there were no more recordings. And during the Brady violations hearing, she wasn't there. And the judge was quite adamant that she had misled him.
Mm-hmm. And the judge could sanction these attorneys, yes?
He put sanctions on the government. So he was not considering sanctions on individuals. He sanctioned the government, which is sort of an abstract thing. I think most people grapple with that concept. And the sanction was that for the 10 defendants who brought this motion, they cannot ever bring a conspiracy to riot charge against. He dismissed that charge with prejudice. The prosecution moved to dismiss 7 charges without prejudice, which means that we could bring them again against the defendants in order to avoid the sanctions hearing. And the defense actually objected to the charges being dismissed because they wanted them dismissed with prejudice and they wanted a hearing on sanctions. And as a result, the judge accepted the prosecution's motion to dismiss without prejudice on all of the charges except for conspiracy to riot, in which case for these 10 defendants, he dismissed with prejudice, finding that the violation was intentional. He said he could not rule on whether it was malevolent or not because Kirkhoff was not there to explain herself and he didn't really want to hear from her again. And then after that, the prosecution dismissed the charges for the remaining 3 defendants, but only in this group. There's 46 other people who are not impacted by this, including the 4 who were on trial last week. So and in that case, the judge found Brady violation, but did not find to be intentional and refused to rule one way or the other on a mistrial.
So when there is a Brady violation, you don't, if you're the defendant, you don't necessarily come out ahead in any way. You could be the subject to a Brady, you could be subject to a Brady violation and still then not have anything to show for it in terms of your defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's really depends on the judge. I think standard response is to suppress the evidence and the judge, if they find it intentional. I mean, the prosecution claims this wasn't intentional. They just cut the video without watching it, which, assuming they did that, that raises serious questions as to why they're getting a video from a third party and then not watching it. And they're speaking to its authenticity and they haven't even watched the whole video. I mean, even if they're not lying, which I'm not going to say they're not, that's really a substantial error on their part. But the one judge who is ex-defense attorney was just not having any of it.
Tell us also about this motorcycle cop who testified and then put a T-shirt on. After he left the courtroom.
Apparently, police officers, when they're testifying on trial in D.C. court, they wear their uniforms. When they walk around the courthouse, they're supposed to wear a cover shirt, a shirt that covers up their uniform. He elected to wear as his cover shirt a shirt that said, police brutality or doing what their parents should have done, with a picture of a baton with handcuffs around it. And he not only wore this shirt around the courthouse, he walked into the courtroom to talk to the court reporter in full view of the defense, who, of course, did what any person, any competent defense attorney would do, and took a picture of him. And he was initially a prosecution witness, but the defense called him again as a defense witness to ask him about this lovely T-shirt he was wearing. And there was a report in The Intercept, and you will be shocked to learn this, John, but apparently this officer has in the past been accused of police brutality. I was just totally, totally surprised to discover the guy wearing the shirt glorifying police brutality has been accused of it.
That's just too perfect. I read in an article in the Washington Post that this policeman, as you said, was recalled by the defense to testify about the T-shirt.
Yes.
He did. And as he left the stand, he was booed and the judge planted his face in the palm of his hand.
I didn't know about that. I can imagine. I mean, it is my understanding was that when he testified the first time, he was extremely combative and kept referring to the defendants as rioters, even though the prosecution is not allowed to do so because they're on trial.
And in fact, the judge specifically said the judge sustained an objection by the defense and specifically said that he could not refer to them as rioters. And he continued doing it.
There's some speculation that he is coordinated with the prosecution. I mean, I don't know. The guy sounds like a character. I can imagine him.
Yeah, I think that's...
He lacks judgment. I would describe him as someone lacking judgment. I mean, I could not imagine wearing a pro-police brutality shirt in a courtroom in front of the defense attorney. It's like, what do you think is going to happen?
What are you thinking?
I mean, I'm not going to defend that sentiment, but it's one thing to harbor it. It's another thing to lack the common sense to not walk into a courtroom to talk to the court reporter in front of the defense.
We got about 2.5 minutes left, and I want to ask you, where do we go from here? So where do these other 46 people go? They're going to go on trial. The prosecution has a terrible track record so far. They haven't been able to prove anybody's identities so far, except for the people who elected to plead guilty when they were initially charged. So now what?
It's unclear. I mean, with the trials that were declared a mistrial and the prosecution has 30 days to refile them, I don't know if they're going to do that. With the exception of the 10 conspiracy to riot charges, all of the trial charges have been dismissed, including the 129 that were dismissed back in January without prejudice. So they could bring them again at any time.
For how long?
I don't know the statute of limitations. I think it's something like 8 years or something.
Is it that long?
I think it might be. I'm not 100% sure, but it's a long statute of limitations. And so, and they still have 40-some people they could try. I mean, I imagine the remaining defense attorneys will bring the Brady violation claim again because it's in all the cases. And it's just, I don't see how they can go on with this. Mm-hmm. I know on the first day of this trial, the U.S. attorney was in the audience. One of the defendant's supporters recognized her and went up to her and said, "Hi, Miss Liu," and said, "Hello." So it was her. And the fact that she's in there watching, I think, shows that there's some skepticism about this. I mean, forget about what their ideological commitments are. They've spent 17 months on these 200-some charges. They have...
And imagine the cost to the taxpayer.
Tremendous, tremendous, tremendous. And it's worth pointing out that in both the first trial and the second trial, the defense brought a motion for judgment of acquittal on the incitement charge, and a judge found it for all of the 6 defendants in the first trial and 2 in the second one. And it's very rare for a judge to, after the prosecution rests their case, when they view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government,
that's right.
The standard, light most favorable to the government, say, no reasonable jury can find this. I mean, I talk to people who are criminal defense attorneys like, oh yeah, we always make that motion.
Sure, but nobody ever wins.
And, you know, these are fairly pro-prosecution judges, and that incitement charge was just thrown out. I mean, it's really humiliating for Jennifer Kirkhoff and the U.S. Attorney's Office.
It has to be. And I think it's not going to get any better. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Chip Gibbons. Chip is the policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist who has contributed to The Nation, Jacobin Magazine, and the book The Henry Kissinger Files. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. This is Nicole Roussel sitting in for Brian Becker, and I'm joined here in the studio by John Kiriakou. Brazil took another step into privatization today when they auctioned off some of their nation's oil fields. This is just days after truckers in Brazil have ended their 10-day strike over fuel prices, increasing the chaos under Temer's rule since the parliamentary coup 2 years ago. We're joined from Bangkok by Pepe Escobar. He's a writer and political analyst. Welcome, Pepe.
Nice to be with you guys again.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. My pleasure.
What happened yesterday in the oil auction? And was this related? How is this related to the trucker strike that was going on over fuel prices?
Well, it's a very long process. It's the latest chapter in the dismantling of Petrobras, which is a national champion in Brazil. So try to imagine the same thing happening with the ExxonMobil, with the Petronas in Malaysia, Pertamina in Indonesia, the National Iranian Oil Company in Iran, or Rosneft in Russia. Imagine any government in all of these nations willingly surrendering one of their national champions in terms of their big corporations. In the case of Petrobras, responsible for over 10% of Brazil's budget, and selling it piece by piece to foreign competitors. So the auction that we had is just another small chapter in the whole thing. In fact, they auction fields of pre-salt reserves that are not among the best ones. In fact, they got over $1 billion from Statoil in Norway, from ExxonMobil, in fact, from Chevron, from Portugal. It's not much, but when you see what's been happening with Petrobras, especially for the past year and a half, including finally the CEO giving himself a pink slip a few days ago, Mr. Parente, it's absolutely horrible in terms of how you destroy one of the flowers of your industry, in fact. And it's there was a very important meeting in Rio earlier this week where you had some of the best Brazilian experts in energy. And they were all unanimous. Some of them worked for Petrobras. Some of them are energy analysts. And they were all unanimous in saying that what's going on in terms of how you dismantle a company that, by the way, has no debt. The myth sold by Brazilian corporate media that Petrobras is in the red is absolutely false. And these guys proved with numbers. I wish I had time to give you all the breakdown and the lowdown of what's been happening. In fact, for the past 5 years, including charts and numbers saying that Petrobras was a company that was working very well. There was the scandal in terms of corruption involving Petrobras and different political parties in Brasilia was one part of the equation, but it doesn't explain how the company was doing well in terms of being well managed. And this ties up with something that is also very, very important, which is Petrobras nowadays, in terms of the managerial staff at the top, especially after the impeachment of Dilma and Lula being thrown in jail, illegally, by the way, is they respond basically to their shareholders. The shareholders are mostly Americans, in fact. So Petrobras is being more or less redesigned and downsized and sold bits and pieces, and could probably become, assuming what we have for the moment in Brazil, which is not even a government. I cannot even say these people are government because they don't know what they're doing. If we had this for another 2 or 3 years, it would become like a small subsidiary of Chevron or ExxonMobil. And I'm not saying that. What people who are saying that are people who actually know Petrobras from the inside and have worked inside Petrobras for decades and know the exact numbers and how Petrobras is an extremely well-managed company. But it was caught up in the middle of a huge political scandal.
So do you think this is actually the start of full privatization? I mean, I cannot imagine that the Brazilian people would let that happen. But, you know, it seems like a good bit was privatized yesterday.
You're right, Nicole. In terms of Brazilian public opinion, this is absolutely impossible. And the fact that this government, once again, we cannot possibly call Michel Temer a president. His disapproval rate is 97%. So he's the inverse Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un in North Korea, right? And everybody who's his ministers and the people who support him in Brasilia are equally despised by the overwhelming majority of the Brazilian population. There is, I would say there's a groundswell of good information flowing, especially through independent websites and through social networks, explaining to the average Brazilian voter, for instance, the real situation of Petrobras, how Petrobras is being manipulated as part of a very complex political process that is basically geared to emarginate the Workers' Party and any hint of a progressive government for Brazil in the near future, and how the company is being sold and being dismantled, in fact. What we've been seeing for, the past 18 months is just the beginning. It could get much worse if in the elections, the next presidential elections in October and November, we have a right-wing president, which it's unlikely, because what Brazilian mainstream media doesn't tell anybody is that Lula wins in every possible poll in the first instance, and even if there is a rematch, a second tour, he's going to win as well, assuming he runs. And his candidacy is going to be put on the table in the next few hours. So it's a done deal. And even if he's in jail, he's going to run. Or if he cannot run, he's going to appoint what will be his successor. And this guy is going to win the election. So this process can be reverted. The problem is it has been started. Obviously, if you are an executive at Chevron or ExxonMobil or Statoil in Norway, you look at the Brazilian pre-salt reserves and you see one of the biggest energy prices in the world up for grabs. So for the moment, we can have more auctions. We can have, one or two, three fields here and there for $1, $2, $5, $10 billion being sold. But this can be reverted later on. And a lot of people among progressive politicians in Brazil, there are not many, but they still exist. They are saying, no, we're going to revert anything that this government is doing, especially in terms of Petrobras policy.
And I mean, it seems to me that is more the way that most of the Brazilian residents, are really thinking, which I want to go back to the trucker strike briefly, because I have just been so amazed to see, we've heard rumors that the strike was infiltrated by reactionaries really pushing for military intervention. You would think, it's unlikely that the people of Brazil are really pushing for a military dictatorship. They've had that. That's been the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. I mean, I have to imagine that the infiltration rumors are true. What do you think?
It's crazy, Nicole. I grew up in a military dictatorship. In fact, when the military coup happened in 1964, I was 10 years old. So we all, my generation especially, we all remember very well what it is living under a military dictatorship. And new generation, and even millennials in Brazil, they grew up with democracy. And that we would never come back to a situation where we had direct foreign interference with a military coup and a military dictatorship, old school style. Forget it. What we are having at the moment, which is much worse, in fact, is a very sophisticated form of hybrid war that managed to strike judicial, parliamentary, media, and big business coup in Brazil. The first part of the coup was to get rid of Dilma when she was impeached illegally. The second part of the coup in the car wash investigation was to throw Lula in jail. The only thing that they actually mattered for them from the beginning was to put Lula in jail, because then he could never, that's exactly where we are now, he could never run for a third term. Everybody knows that if Lula runs, he wins. Everybody in Brazil, even people who have zero political consciousness, it's a fact of life, like death and taxes, the Lula story in Brazil. So the Brazilian elites, which I happen to know very well when I still lived in Brazil, I wrote for the big Brazilian papers, I knew these people, I met them everywhere, I traveled with President Cardoso when he used to come to Europe to display his vanity, especially when he was getting prizes in universities in France or in Italy. And of course, I remember very well the neoliberal shock. Cardoso used to be a champion of global South development, and he became a neoliberal in the 90s. And in the 2000s, even worse, when Lula was president for 8 years, His biggest opponent was, in fact, Cardozo, because he was not in the spotlight anymore. So there was a component of vanity and ego trip, of course, wounded ego. And the fact that Lula, Brazil was growing under Lula, 6%, 7%, 8%. And Brazil was respected all over the world as one of the leaders of the global south. The BRICS got an enormous impulse when Lula was in power. Brazil was respected in Beijing and in Moscow. Lula was respected all over the world, including President Obama, who used to say, oh, I wish I could be a politician like Lula. The UNASUR, which is the Union of the South American Countries, got a big boost as well. And this whole nexus of Brazil as one of the most important poles in terms of trying to find an alternative development model, an alternative model of international relations, was due to a greater extent to what Lula was doing and his foreign minister, Celso Amorim. So this was all lost afterwards. The coup that happened basically 2 years ago managed to destroy the Brazilian economy in less than 2 years, which is an enormous feat. Brazil has still, what, $350 billion in reserves. That's not so bad. But the Brazilian industry is completely destroyed. The Brazilian champions, which is Petrobras and the big construction companies, completely destroyed.
Well, we've got to leave it right there, Pepe. We've been joined from Bangkok by Pepe Escobar. He's a writer and political analyst. Thanks so much for listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. This is Nicole Roussel sitting in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can read at lefty.blogspot.com, lefti.blogspot.com. What do you have for us this week, Steve?
Well, we're going to start in Gaza this week, which is, of course, a continuing source of news and also a continuing source of disgusting headlines. The first one is from the New York Times, and it's actually a good example of how important headlines are. The headline reads, "A woman dedicated to saving lives loses hers in Gaza violence." And of course, this is about the medic Razan Al-Majar, who was murdered by Israel. And the headline, of course, there's two of the usual problems. She lost her life. No, you lose your life if you fall off a cliff or you're in an automobile accident or something like that.
That's right.
If you're shot by a sniper, you don't lose your life. You're assassinated. You're murdered. You're killed.
And we should be using the subject too, right? Israeli snipers murder this person.
Exactly. And of course, Gaza violence is also a very misleading phrase. It was entirely one-sided violence. But the interesting point about this headline is that the article itself is actually a very decent article. It's got a nice portrait of her and her life. It has a video with an interview with her, which is quite positive. So if you actually read the article and watched the video, you could get a very favorable impression of this young woman and feel very outraged by her murder. But the headline itself is giving you the opposite impression.
To your point, I mean, this really draws home why we do this segment, right? I mean, I think many people scroll through headlines and that's the extent of news, which in some cases works fine. But if you're reading an article like this, all you get out of that headline is somebody died, something's going on in Gaza that's violent, but it's not really clear that it's actually like some of the most violent, one-sided, like ethnic cleansing that's going on the planet.
Right. But lest you get the impression that the New York Times has suddenly turned, soft on Palestine, or soft on Israel, rather. Just yesterday, there's a new headline, new article, in the New York Times, and the headline reads, "Israeli video portrays medic killed in Gaza as tool of Hamas." Okay. First of all, there's no evidence whatsoever that Razan Al-Majar had anything to do with Hamas. Israel just throws around the term Hamas like Donald Trump throws around the term fake news. I mean, they just want to label anything that, you know, is bad for them as Hamas, or in Trump's case, fake news. And this video, which they put on their in this article, a major article in the New York Times, is a total propaganda fraud. It has two key features. One, it shows a young woman who I suppose is Razan, although you can't actually tell for sure, but she's picking up a tear gas canister and throwing it as if that's like some offensive act. Well, if you look at the video, first of all, she throws this tear gas canister, which is obviously at her feet, like 20 or 30 feet away. And she throws it in the middle of a field in which there is no one in sight. So it's not like she's throwing it over the fence at Israeli soldiers, nothing of the sort. But that's sort of the first misleading thing in this video, which the New York Times is happy to promote.
She's just doing her job as a medic and trying to clear the area of weapons.
Exactly. And then in a worse case, they actually edit this video, the Israeli propaganda department, the IDF propaganda department, to have her saying she is a human. I am a human shield. But according to Palestinian speakers who've seen the full video, what she actually says is, I'm here as a rescuing human shield to protect and save the wounded at the front lines.
Wow. Wow.
But you won't learn that from the New York Times article or from this video, which they promote in this absolutely disgusting smear piece, which appears in yesterday's paper.
That's not even just taking something out of context. That's completely turning something around into a totally different sentiment.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, those are just absolutely terrible.
Yeah. So just to switch the mood here and to set our target away from Israel and go to capitalism, I'll read the next headline and you can decide whether this is misleading or disgusting or funny or what. American Airlines to debut smaller bathrooms for North American flights.
Ooh, debuting smaller bathrooms.
Yeah, that sounds great. Huh? How small are we talking about?
That's a good question.
We're talking about 24 inches wide.
Mm-mm.
And you might ask, how
Mm-mm.
is that even possible?
Mm-mm.
I just said, while I was sitting here waiting to talk to you, I measured myself.
Oh my God.
Took out a ruler. As far as I can tell, I'm 18 inches wide. I'm a fairly slim individual. I also looked up the width of an average casket.
Oh my God.
That's 28 inches.
What?
So the new American Airlines bathrooms.
Smaller than a casket.
In their ever-ending quest for profit over people's comfort needs or whatever, are actually 4 inches less wide, 4 inches narrower than a casket. So happy flight, everyone.
It gives new meaning to sardines in a tin can. You're just a sardine in a casket, I guess.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
yes.
And this is as Americans are getting bigger and bigger and bigger all
right.
the time.
And it turns out, no matter what size you are, I would argue that you still have a right to use a bathroom on a flight. That seems like a basic right that we have for people, right? Is that in the Constitution? No?
Amazing.
You know, I've been watching the NBA Finals. I'm pretty sure LeBron has shoulders that are wider than 24 inches.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's quite a wingspan.
I guess he'll be flying first. First class bathrooms will probably be wider, though, so he probably doesn't have to worry.
That's true, but there's less successful basketball players than LeBron who can't afford first class, and they've got wingspans, too. Man, that's nuts.
Well, here's one which I really got a kick out of. Israel, and this is from the Newsweek, Israel responds with Mean Girls GIF after Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini's nuclear threat.
Oh, my God.
Well, if you've ever seen Mean Girls, happens to be one of my favorite movies.
It's a great film.
Terrific film.
It's so good.
Hilarious.
They have a musical now.
Are they right?
Yeah, that's right. I've been meaning to go see it. I'll let you know.
Anyway, this GIF is Rachel McAdams. Who is supposed to be Israel, talking to Iran, saying, why are you so obsessed with me? Well, first of all, gee, I can't imagine why Iran would be obsessed with Israel, considering Israel is trying to drum up support for the entire world to go to war against Iran. So, you know, that's the bigger insult actually is, and probably unintended on the part of Israel, is that in this analogy, Iran is Lindsay Lohan, which who used to be a, you know, wonderful young woman. But I'm afraid she's had a turn for the worse in life, so that's too bad.
Oh, my gosh.
By the way, Khomeini did not make any nuclear threats. They ordered it. They said they're going to increase enrichment of uranium, so that's not a threat anyway.
It seems like it, you know, could be related to the fact that we left the Iran nuclear agreement. Do you think that's maybe related to why he said that?
Yes, indeed. And of course, they did say that the increased enrichment will be within the bounds of the JCPOA, which they're no longer really bound to since the U.S. has essentially canceled it.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, let's move on.
We've only got time for a couple more. Yeah, what else do we have?
Okay, let's go to the other side of the world, in North Korea.
Okay.
This one, I called it misleading. You could also call it funny. The headline from Reuters reads, North Korea's three new military leaders are loyal to Kim, not policies.
Sounds like a classic headline. Tell us more about this.
Classic headline. What's funny about it, or misleading, whatever, is that one of these people who is allegedly loyal to Kim, whose name is Ri Yong Gil, was actually, who was just named at the Army Chief of General Staff. In 2016, just 2 years ago, the BBC reported that he was executed for disloyalty.
Wow.
So we can't keep...
How did a dead man get... Yeah. How did he get elevated? You would think they'd want somebody alive for that position.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Or somebody who was actually loyal and not so disloyal he was worthy of being executed. I don't know.
That's right. Disloyal corpses are not great to elevate to Chief of General Staff.
The source of this story is, quote, a senior U.S. official and North Korea leadership analysts in Seoul, whose total veracity on the subject of North Korea over the years has proven to be nearly nil. But yet they keep getting published and relied upon by the media. So,
yeah, I mean, this is one in a long line of, Kim Jong-un fed, son to dogs, all sorts of like ridiculous sounding rumors that are just complete propaganda. Well, I think we've got time for one more, Steve. What do you got?
Let's go with another Kim one, which I liked as a media. Kim Jong-un's image shift from nuclear madman to skillful leader. That's from the New York Times.
That was fast.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thrust of this article is that it was Kim who changed. But of course, the reality is it wasn't Kim who changed at all. It was the corporate media trying to reflect a certain reality with the upcoming summit and so on. Kim did not shift at all. He was never a nuclear madman as portrayed. He was always a skillful leader. In fact, the media is putting on Kim what is really their own shift, is the point of this item.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen that reflected in pictures, too. Pictures of Kim used to be frowning and now are smiling. We have been joined by Steve Pat from the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News.
We are completely out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.